The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. There are four of us here today. Me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Michael Calvin. You have the time it takes for me to finish this intro to guess which two have spent the last year painstakingly researching and writing in-depth football books and which two have sat about like lemons. As well as books, we'll round up the week's football as Liverpool continue their title challenge. Leeds lead the way in the Championship while QPR have 0 points and a goal difference of minus 11. We'll look ahead to this weekend's Premier League fixtures and we'll speculate on which leaders of the past Paul Scholes could pick out of a lineup. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Football Weekly Extra. We have a panel today, as mentioned. Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
You have not written a book.
No, and I suspect I never will.
Jonathan Wilson, you have written a book.
I have. It's called The Barcelona Legacy and it's available now.
And is it good?
Sensational.
Mike Calvin, lovely to see you.
And to you.
You have also written a book.
It's called State of Play and it is absolutely wonderful and it's out very soon. In fact, today.
Is it better than Jonathan Wilson's book?
I would doubt that I have Jonathan's erudition, but I investigate the human psyche wonderfully well.
Excellent. Beeston writes...
Surely, Max, as host, you've read both books and can judge for yourself which is better.
I delegate, because it's important to delegate. So what I've done is I've delegated you the role of reading Mike Calvin's book.
Which I have done.
And for the interests of ongoing running jokes, I have vowed never to read a book written by Jonathan Wilson.
As have I.
So hopefully Mike has read Jonathan Wilson's book.
But you did promise last night to give me a quid rather than buying it.
Well, I said, shall I buy it? So you got some royalties. And you just said, just give me a pound.
Yeah.
So...
It cuts out the middleman.
Okay, fine. Well, I'm happy to do that.
Anybody listening who wants to do that, that's also a perfectly fine arrangement.
You just
give me a quid, don't bother with it.
PayPal is fine. Yeah. The biggest game that has happened since we did the pod was Liverpool's 2-0 win at Crystal Palace. Jonathan, they ground this out more than just hoping that they will win every game like Man City do, so we have a title race. And they didn't necessarily do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Palace would be relatively... happy with how they played. You know, I thought, as ever with Roy Hodgson's league side, you know, his club sides, they looked very well organised. Liverpool just had a bit of extra quality and got the bit of luck with getting the penalty, which I think probably was, but you know, it wouldn't have been a scandal if it hadn't been given. So yeah, they did enough. And given how many points they dropped last season against some mid-table sides, that's probably a good sign for Liverpool.
Roy was very upset about the penalty, Barry.
Yeah, and... I can understand, I suppose, why he thought it might shouldn't have been given, but his defence was, and I quote, there's no way he's looking to foul the player. That's irrelevant whether he was looking to foul the player or not. You know, he could still have fouled the player. Some think he did, some think he didn't. Michael Oliver's opinion is the only one that counts, and he thought it was a foul.
I only saw the last 4 minutes of that game thanks to the intellectual genii of Thameslink, who decided to stop running trains for about 90 minutes. My image of that night is a still of Roy Hodgson looking like he's just about to bite the head off a fluffy kitten. And alongside him, you've got Jurgen Klopp, who looks to be undergoing some sort of colonic irrigation. And I'm thinking, well, OK, I understand Roy and... is a wonderful man when you're getting away from a football match. After games, he is just unplayable sometimes. I've seen him say some terrible things to journalists who've asked him perfectly good questions and have basically been dismembered.
I mean, if that's the case, it's a strange choice of career. Roy, I mean, it's a bit late to change.
72?
Yeah. Andros Townsend hit the bar very early and by cutting onto his left foot and doing exactly what Andros Townsend does. And I was wondering if... Is it annoying for him that his trademark is Arjen Robben's trademark and Robben is much better at the trademark? So Andros Townsend will never have the trademark. Are there other footballers that do things in such a way that it would be their trademark if they were better at it?
Andros Townsend has never scored more than 4 goals in a season, which he did... while at Newcastle in 2015-16. He got three for Palace in 2016-17, and the rest is a series of ones, noughts and twos in a career going back to 2007. So
he is not deserving of a trade.
An average of two a season sounds about right.
Yeah, you're probably right. Mike, we've been saying a lot on this pod so far that we're very keen for Liverpool to mount a challenge to Manchester City. Can you see them doing that?
I can. I've been daft enough or romantic enough to actually suggest that they'll actually succeed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just think if you look at Liverpool as they stand, the one danger is their greatest strength, which is the emotional intensity of the football club. It could become one of these out-of-control crusades if they don't watch the emotion that is generated by the hope that is obviously there. If you take away that, strategically they've got it right in terms of recruitment is a long-term strategy. They were prepared to wait for the players like a Van Dijk, like Keita, who seems to be the sort of final piece in that cliched jigsaw. They look pretty good at the back. I think Gomez alongside Van Dijk is a massive upgrade. There's a solidity there, and it'll be very interesting to see if Jurgen Klopp can actually control the sort of roller coaster that he's actually switched into operation.
I'd be surprised if they overhauled City, but they're definitely the 19. I'd say they're definitely the best equipped to do so. My issue with Naby Keita, I mean, I agree with you. I think I'm not sure he's a better player than Coutinho, but he sort of fits the system better. My issue with him is purely that for ages, every time I typed his name, autocorrect engine to Baby Keith. So, but yeah, that's not really his fault.
No, it isn't.
Get great merchandise out of that, wouldn't you?
Barry, Mino Raiola's had a fun week, hasn't he? And he's taken to Twitter, which seems to be the right place for super agents to go to criticise pundits. Paul Scholes was having a go at Paul Pogba for saying he was inconsistent, not offered enough support to Lukaku and Martial. This was after the defeat to Brighton we talked about on Monday. Raiola said Paul Scholes wouldn't recognise a leader if he was in front of Sir Winston Churchill. Some people need to talk for fear of being forgotten.
Yeah, well, I don't have any issue with what Mino Raiola said. I think it was a gag. It wasn't particularly funny. It was a bit of a slap down. But I thought Paul Scholes' comments were slightly odd, that, you know, he couldn't believe that Pogba admitted he had a bad game, and I'm not sure what his problem is at that. You know, he said it's all right for him to think he had a bad game, but don't admit it. You know, we know he had a bad game. We were watching it. We can tell. So I'm not sure what either man's point is, really.
In your book, Mike, you say agents have reshaped the landscape with their cynicism and desperation. Would you put Raiola into that camp?
Yep. Anyone who gets called a shitbag by Sir Alex Ferguson is okay by me. Manchester United is a really interesting case study of the sort of power dynamics of modern football, where, you know, frankly, Mourinho's howling at the moon at the moment simply because he's lost control, he's lost respect, and if you look around, Pogba has the influence because he has the social media penetration. Ed Woodward has the reins of power simply because, despite all this kerfuffle that there's been over the last couple of weeks and the pre-season tour from hell, Manchester United's share price is at a record level.
So, which is kind of a trophy.
It's the only one they're going to win this season. I just can't see. If you look at Manchester United at the moment, there's almost, you know, there is an emotional disconnect even within the club. The club is almost schizophrenic. There are two aspects of it. There is the football operation, you know, with the statues and Old Trafford and Carrington. And then there is the true heartbeat of the club, which is in Mayfair. And, you know, the guys in suits who are selling you know, coal to Newcastle in New South Wales and tractors to Omsk. And they're the ones who ultimately will be the agents of power within that football club.
We're going to look ahead to United Spurs in part three. Last night in the Championship, Aston Villa got a last-minute equaliser at home to Brentford. Jonathan Codger scored twice for Villa. Neil Maupay getting both for Brentford, although he probably should have been sent off with a score at 1-1 for a stamp. JCT says, Barry, what is more annoying, a player scoring against you after they should have been sent off, or Max?
I'm not that fussed about either, really.
It's an interesting turnaround for Villa, isn't it? When you think about, you know, at some point in the summer, it was like they're going to have to sell Jack Grealish for 20p, and now they're getting Yannick Bolasie in, they're talking to Tammy Abraham. That's a, for the fans, it's sort of a massive relief, I guess.
Well, they were, you know, looking down the barrel at, dare I say, Sunderland Mark II.
Well, actually, they're in a worse situation. I think the financial pressures were even tighter on Villa than they were on Sunderland.
Mm. And so it's great what a couple of Egyptian billionaires do for your life, isn't it, really? And in a way, I'm quite pleased that Steve Bruce has been able to be given the opportunity to finish, you know, the job he began. You know, when we were talking about Thierry Henry turning up there, I just thought that was pretty facile, really. I just couldn't see the logic of that, unless you just wanted to, you know, a trophy manager. If you've got a trophy manager in that situation, you probably haven't got any trophies in your cabinet. So I think. And also, the championship is the Gamblers' League, and it looks like that after having been chucked out of the casino, Villa have sort of, you know, body swerved the bouncers, got back in again. Now they're at the blackjack table yet again, and who knows? They might, well, the gamble might come off this year.
It might not for Stoke, in all sorts of trouble. 3-0 home defeat by Wigan. Here's the transfer that no one noticed, Ashley Williams.
Yes.
I saw him getting sent off and I was like, oh.
Where's he?
He's at Stoke.
Is he?
Yeah.
Seems like a good signing for Stoke. It does.
Not on the evidence of last night's performance.
But Stuart James has always been very sceptical of Ashley Williams. And yeah, he obviously saw Swansea a lot more than I ever did. And yeah, he's a, yeah, knows football. So maybe.
At one point he was going to save Arsenal's defence, wasn't he, Ashley Williams? There were rumours.
Well, he had a very torrid time at Everton, and who obviously don't want him anymore. They've shipped him out to Stoke, and he had a bit of a Kennedy last night. He was directly responsible for one goal, could be conceivably be held responsible for a second, and was sent off. So, and while Gary Rowett didn't name him specifically, in the wake of a very embarrassing 3-0 hiding at home to Wigan, who, you know, have just come up from League One, he did say that he wasn't going to pick players on reputation, that he was going to pick players instead who deserved to be in his team, which was a not too subtle dig at Mr. Williams.
Mark says, Max, you obviously know how far a cute face, trendy haircut and hipster designer stubble can get you. Do you think this has been the reason Gary Rowett has been hired by so many clubs? Mike, I think Rowett has... I actually thought his sacking at Birmingham was the worst decision football has ever seen.
Might be overstating the point, but I get where you're coming from. He's a little bit of the sort of the English version of Marco Silva. Everyone thinks he's a good coach, good manager, but has he actually proved it? He's got to the point where the jury was sort of out, and then... before anyone could come to a conclusion, he leaps onto the next club. You know, you can't fault his ambition. I do take your point about Birmingham. It was an absolutely, you know, joke decision to get rid of him. He needs to prove himself. He really does. And it's interesting, the dynamic of a relegation team. There is always the unspoken assumption that when you come down, it's a matter of time before everything clicks and you're back up again. Now, I know it's only, what, 3-4 games in, but when you have a pretty devastating home defeat like they had last night, the murmurs will start to circulate. And we're not in Steve McLaren territory, far from it, but it could be quite an interesting few weeks if they don't you know, improve.
There was also a half-time tunnel bust-up between assorted Stoke players fighting amongst themselves. 4 games into the season, that's not a very good sign.
Let's go into Steve McLaren territory. QPR, 0 points, lost 3-0 at home to Bristol City on the back of that hammering at West Brom. We should spare a thought for Antti Korpela, who flew from his native Finland to watch 2 games in 4 days. And he saw the 7-1 defeat to West Brom and the 3-0 defeat His last trip was he went over in February to watch a 5-2 home defeat by Nottingham Forest. Steve McLaren, how long will he be at the reins? Or do you think this is where the Big Sam klaxon will be sounded first?
I don't know. I mean, there's so many other issues going on there. But, I mean, letting in 6.5 is never a great sign, is it? And, you know, I always think managers deserve more time than they tend to get. But if a slide is as rapid as that, I mean, that's, you know, to concede 6.5 suggests either that you're playing a team several divisions above you in the cup and you can't touch them, or morale has just disintegrated. And if morale's disintegrated, the only way of putting that right is the sacrifice of the manager, probably.
QPR's Twitter account has taken a bit of a hammering from the 21st of August. Because they don't score many goals, they've put a lovely photo and said, "What a goal this would have been," and added Mats Luongo, which looks like quite a good effort and overhead kick.
The problem with any QPR player doing overhead kick, though, is you know it's never going to be the best QPR overhead kick.
Well, so. You're absolutely right. Norwich 2, Preston 0. Two late goals for Norwich, presumably because Preston ran out of testosterone late in the second half after Norwich City painted the away dressing room a deep pink, a colour that is said to lower testosterone levels and have a calming effect on people.
Sunderland did this when they moved in the stadium alight. We were talking about Premier Passions last night. That was one of the things in it, that they painted the away dressing room. I think it was sort of a bluish grey with purple bits. That was supposed to sort of induce kind of a sleepiness in the opposition.
I prefer the more fundamentalist approach at Millwall. Just flood the away dressing room and see how they get on with it.
Yeah, or the John Beck approach. Just if it's hot outside, make it freezing inside and vice versa. Dr. Alexander Latignac, a lecturer in sports psychology at the University of Suffolk, says pink has an effect, not because it is pink, but because it's linked to childhood experiences. If it is true that pink lowers testosterone levels, the coach should know exactly how to use that advantage tactically. I think I heard him on the radio yesterday saying, well, actually, it can induce calm in players as well. So actually, it could have the opposite effect. You know, it just depends on...
So you're saying Lee Catmull should have a little pink room for himself?
Absolutely right.
Or Stoke should put it in their tunnels.
The only 100% record has gone. Leeds drew 2-2 at Swansea. Ollie McBurney, the new Steve Claridge, getting both of the Swans goals. Millwall, Mike, lost 2-1 at Sheffield Wednesday. You want to have a gripe about the red button.
The red button. It's actually... It's almost a throwback to the early days of TV. One single camera.
Sorry, you should probably just explain to our foreign listeners what the red button is.
Ah, well, the red button is when you tune in to Sky Sports to watch the main game, which was the Aston Villa game last night, you could have access to the other championship games on the red button. You press the red button and, hey presto, you've got five games up there. I happened, through force of habit, to choose Sheffield Wednesday against Millwall. Didn't recognise Millwall for the first 70 minutes. No urgency, very sloppy, completely un-Millwall-like. But partly that was because of the coverage. I felt immense sympathy for the commentator, who it seems probably didn't even have a team sheet. It was one single camera, and it reached its sort of natural conclusion, if you like. And by the way, there were no replays. It was just as is. And there were some substitutions in the second half, and the camera had gazed longingly at the opposing goalkeeper, who was basically standing on the edge of his area picking his nose. And the substitutes came on. And eventually, after about 2 minutes, the commentator said, oh, yes, Charlie Farnes-Barnes and whoever's come on. We didn't see that act at all. It was almost sort of, football through the veil.
Well, it sounds like something nostalgic about it, though.
Yeah, and the other thing was, it made a bad evening worse, was that I'd forgotten that Sheffield Wednesday is the home of that bloody England band. So Millwall were playing appallingly. Sheffield Wednesday, who hadn't, couldn't get a kick for the first four games of the season, were winning. And all I heard were this parping nonsense behind one goal.
Hey, Sunderland are doing all right. 4-1 from 1-0 down as well.
Yeah, and two very good goals. I think it was maybe the scoreline flattered on slightly that they took their chance. They scored their only four shots on target. But, you know, if you can win 4-1 against a team as good as Gillingham...
Tough place to go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's miles away. It's in Kent. without it seems playing especially... And I thought the pressing that led to the third goal showed exactly what Jack Ross is trying to do and showed how that's... how effective he's been. But just on Leeds, who went top of the championship on Tuesday, I was at Scarborough for the cricket on Monday and Tuesday, and there was something really weird about sitting in a stand full of elderly Yorkshiremen wearing tweed and flat caps, going, oh, I do like that Bielsa. I love the way he's got them pressing. Oh, I've never seen them press like that. And you sort of think, what's happened? What's gone wrong with the world? That these people who should be sort of talking of, you know, you're happily reminiscing about a Jeff Boycott forward defensive in 1968, are instead talking about Marcelo Bielsa leading Leeds to victory over Rotherham. Something's gone badly wrong there. But anyway, they seem to be... I mean, I don't think they played especially well on Tuesday, and it was, I think, indicative of Bielsa's ruthlessness. He made a change after 28 minutes and another one at half-time. So he made changes and they worked.
I know it's good management to do that if it makes a change. I still feel there's an unwritten rule that no player should ever be taken off in the first half because it's just, you just think that's so depressing, isn't it?
Which is worse, being taken off in the first half or being sent on and then taken off again?
Oh, that's the ultimate. I mean, that is the ultimate insult.
I know a guy who retired from senior hurling in Ireland because that was done to him.
Yeah, I mean, both are bad, aren't they?
Yeah. Bielsa, you know, you know him better probably than any of us, Jonathan. What's with this sitting on a bucket? You know, is that just some sort of affectation?
I don't know, because in Marseille he sat on a cool box thing.
Why doesn't he kind of sit in the rally seats?
Well, he used to, when he was at Athletic, the thing he was famous for was he would take 13 paces across the technical area, and it's always 13 paces. And if he started sort of in the middle, he'd take these sort of tiny little steps. And he kept on being asked about it. And I think he got so annoyed at that, he thought, well, I'm not going to walk about anymore. So he's obviously, his brain works in a very particular way. And that 13 steps thing was clearly part of his self-control or whatever. And if I think sitting on a plastic impromptu seat somehow kind of helps him get over that.
I mean,
who are we to question?
A cool box, I would say a cool box is a much safer seat.
A milking stool sounds like the ideal thing.
Than an upturned bucket.
The Yorkshire Post on Monday was comparing him to a shepherd, which my understanding from James Herriot novels is that that's a pretty big compliment in Yorkshire. So do shepherds have any kind of stool?
Not that I'm aware of. No. They have crooks.
Sort of think wherever Bielsa goes next, you know, somebody could just put a sort of slightly flat inanimate thing and just see if he went for it. This is sad news from League One. Peterborough won again. Top of League One, won all their games. 1-0 at Charlton. Nick says, in light of what is happening at Charlton, can Max please do his impression of Jim White saying, Roland de Châtelet on today's podcast? Look, I would have done it anyway. Staff at Charlton have expressed extreme disappointment after bonuses they say were promised to them by the owner, Roland de Châtelet, were not paid. He sent an email saying the incentivised bonuses would not be paid because the club had endured a very bad financial year. Mike, where do you put de Châtelet in the pantheon of football club owners?
I would put him down a very, very deep hole and never let him out. Okay. What he's done to that club is disgusting, to be frank. And I know the fans are going to protest again on Saturday. We're almost past the positive protest stage. It's almost stay away. I would have great sympathy with any staff member at Charlton Athletic refusing to work. They should pull a mass sickie on Saturday, and the game will have to be postponed. And then the EFL, or the Football League, as I prefer to call them, would have to get off their well-up holstered backsides and do something about it. Because what's going on there, it's bit by bit, destroying a club with great tradition And, you know, something that means something to its community. And I think what's gone on there is terrible.
Has he said anything about he'll leave if somebody comes in, or what's he doing?
Yeah, well, as I understand it, you know, he's been wanting to sell for quite some time. There were some tortuous negotiations with an Australian consortium over the summer. Being a manager there is, I talked to Carl Robinson, funny enough, as part of the new book, First Plug of the Day.
Second, actually.
And he said it was surreal. He had eight people, his eight closest friends in football, all told him not to take the Charlton job, but he did. He understood why they said that to him. 2 days before he took control, he actually went to watch a game at home. I think it was against Sheffield United, when the fans started throwing plastic pigs and taxis onto the pitch. And Carl was sitting there with his daughter, who said, "Dad, can you go and get me a plastic pig, please?" And, well, the manager can't really do that, can he? So there is this just complete, absolute sort of, you know, carnage going on. I noticed Lee Bowyer snapped at the sainted Steve Evans on the other night, didn't he?
Yeah,
I think he made some reference to his girth, which I'm all in favour of.
You also said in the book, Carl Robinson took the job, and then when he went to his first match in the dugout, he was booed by fans after 2 minutes 44 seconds.
Look,
what are you doing here? Get out!
Yeah. I don't understand why you're here, Robinson. He said he actually physically looked at his watch, and it was 2 minutes 44 seconds.
He's a really good lad, Carl Robinson.
At least he had a honeymoon period.
Yeah. Speaking of honeymoon periods,
yes,
Max,
yes,
it's
Barry.
Day five of your honeymoon.
Yeah.
You've spent four of them with me.
Well, okay, Barry, I love you. Is that all you wanted? Portsmouth have 4 wins from 4 as well after a late winner at Bristol Rovers. Ronan Curtis' winner just bobbling over the line. Oxford United, the only team in League One with 0 points. In League Two, Cheltenham have sacked Gary Johnson, only 4 games in to the new League Two season. They made their announcement following the 1-1 draw at Macclesfield, in which both sides picked up their first point of the campaign. Russell Milton has been placed in temporary charge. They're the second EFL side to change their manager this season, following Gary Bowyer's departure from Blackpool after 1 game, which is also news that completely passed me by, as well as Ashley Williams playing for Stoke. Exeter and Lincoln lead the way with a lucky 2-0 win at Exeter with a lucky 2-0 win at the mighty Cambridge United, while Lincoln beat Bury 2-1. The Crew manager, David Artell, has told his players to refund travelling supporters after their 6-0 defeat at Colchester. Barry, will you make a promise to refund the people of Manchester if you don't perform well at the live show on September the 5th alongside Sid Lowe and Lars Sivertsen?
I am not making any rash promises, but I will do my best.
Okay, neither will I, but please come. What would have to happen for us to refund the people coming to Manchester?
The show would have to not take place.
Okay, so if you come and we're there and we brought... It's a bit like, you know, if there's like enough... How many overs do you need of a test match?
It's a 50%.
Okay. Oh, you think 50%? Is that right?
Well, there's a sliding scale of refunds.
I think the most recent... the test before last, I think you only got a refund if less than 15 overs were played.
Okay.
But they'll get the 15 in, don't you worry about that.
Yeah, if we don't do 15 minutes, you get your money back. The September the 5th, but don't after 14 minutes, like, cause something that...
15 minutes on Lars's breakfast.
Yeah, absolutely right. So that's the 5th of September. In Manchester, me, Lars, Sid and Barry on a Casio keyboard playing Mozart's 5th concerto. Oslo, September the 19th, by the way. And you're coming, aren't you, Jonathan?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
I'll also be in Manchester on August the 30th for a Blizzard event.
We have no interest in that.
It's funny enough, I'll be in on August the 31st at a State of Play event.
Oh, I see. Is this why we're not selling enough tickets? Because other people are doing things. It's a great shame, isn't it?
It's a problem if you're going on last. Everybody's money's gone by then.
Yeah, but we're the headline act.
No, we're opening it, though.
Yeah, but, again. You know, it's all... We're like, you know, the aging rockers at Glastonbury that come on and steal the show right at the end. Why are you looking at me like that, Barry?
We really aren't.
Anyway, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll talk about Mike's book and maybe Jonathan's book. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Richie writes, I'm going on holiday next week. I'm on the hunt for some holiday reading. Perhaps Jonathan could suggest something appropriate.
Where's he going?
I don't have that sort of information.
Well, I've become very fond recently of Joseph Hone, who's a sort of 1970s thriller writer. But if you want something on football, then I'm sure Mike's book is as good as all his previous ones.
The Barcelona legacy, Guardiola, Mourinho, and the fight for football.
I mean, like, Guardiola
soul.
And Mourinho are stuck in there to try and kind of make it more
sellable.
Yeah. Okay. What it's really about, I think there's been two periods in football history when you've had a whole series of people at a club, whether they were players or coaches, who then go on to have an enormous impact. One of those was in Budapest in the 1920s, and that's my next book. This one, which I suspect will sell slightly better, is about Barcelona 90. So Cruyff's ideas and how they're taken on by Van Gaal, who obviously inherited the ideas at Ajax as well. And when Van Gaal was manager of Barcelona, he had as his assistants Ronald Koeman, who's obviously slightly less important, and Jose Mourinho, and his midfield was Luis Enrique and Pep Guardiola. So those figures have shaped football over the last 20, 25 years, and how it's played at the top level. And I think Mourinho, although his football is clearly very different from Guardiola's, the principles are actually the same. He's just interpreted them in a different way, whereas somebody like Diego Simeone or Jurgen Klopp just had a very different schooling, so their ideas are different. So Mourinho, although his ideas are almost diametrically opposed to Guardiola's, they are born of the same school. So that's the fundamental idea. And the fact they hate each other obviously makes it much more fun to write about.
Is it a surprise that, you know, such as one, lots of people come from one place have had such an influence? Or should we not be surprised with that because we all sort of follow whoever the biggest people are, and Barcelona are the biggest?
Well, it hasn't happened at any other club. It hasn't. I mean, maybe we'll become more common now that we're in the era of the super clubs where only half a dozen teams can win the Champions League. I think a figure like Cruyff, who has such a distinct idea of how football should be played, for his influence to spread out like that is pretty unusual. And that's partly because he was so charismatic and so dogmatic that everything had to be done his way. There was no compromise. And Guardiola, I guess, is a similar personality. I mean, you see that there's a lot of players who played for Ferguson or for Lobanovsky or for Wenger have gone on to coaching, but I don't think they've taken the ideas forward with the same sort of almost an evangelical zeal that the Guardiola has.
Is the tactics of how we play football, is it cyclical, or is Pep playing a football that we've never seen before, or will at some point it come back round to 4-4-2 and hit the channels?
I mean, there is an element of it being cyclical because you play in a particular way, people work out a way of stopping that. So you it's almost a thesis antithesis, and you get a synthesis. But I think what Guardiola is doing is he's taken those Cruyffian ideas and taken them a stage further. And so that itself has had a huge impact on how football's played. And you see that in 2009, the Champions League final, and Michael Carrick was very good talking about this, United didn't know what to do because United were not used ever to having less than 50% possession, and they could just about deal with the idea of having sort of 45% or 42%. But suddenly when they've only got 30%, they're just panicking, and they lose their structure because they go chasing the ball, because as I said, it's humiliating not to have a ball for them. Well, what then happened when Mourinho's Inter lose 1-0 but win the tie at the Camp Nou the following year in the semi-final of the Champions League, and they have 19% possession, suddenly the stigma's gone. You can win a game with 20% possession, 25% possession. And something I banged on about a lot last year, you may remember, I can see Barry rolling his eyes already.
That's just his resting face.
I know it was specifically after the Newcastle-Manchester City game, which is between Christmas and New Year, and it was almost like Newcastle didn't want the ball. As soon as they got the ball, they kicked it away. And they ended up in that game having something like 23, 24% possession. And it felt odd, but if you look at the Premier League over the last 15 years, the first 3 years Opta kept stats. There were three games in which one team had more than 70% possession. Last season, there were 80-odd. So that idea of one team just bossing the ball and one team playing without the ball, I think as a reaction to Guardiola's Barcelona, has become much more common. And of course, the fact that the disparity in wealth and resources between teams is so great now makes that much more likely to happen.
Here's a question from Darren says, can you please ask Mike what, after writing his recent books, his true feelings are on the professional game? That's a nice, easy, quick question for you.
If I can put it in a very, very sort of short sentence, hopefully, absolutely love the game, absolutely loathe the industry. And what I try to do with the books and this one in particular is actually just to try and, you know, relate the common humanity of the game. You know, don't shy away from the issues and look into some pretty dark crevices, but do so in a way that you can emphasize the humanity of the game, and there's some good people out there working in very bad circumstances. I hope I don't come across as relentlessly negative, because in writing State of Play, I've come across some amazing people and had some pretty profound experiences. You know, to give just one example, the book starts with essentially the last 30 seconds in the life of Jeff Astle. Now, you know, I know this is not old bloke pod, but, you know, Jeff Astle was the man to me of 1968. This book was inspired by Arthur Hopcraft's book, which came out 50 years ago, The Football Man. And I'm sitting in his armchair, looking up at a photograph of him celebrating his goal, which won the FA Cup. And his daughter, Dawn, is telling me of how her father choked to death on his own vomit in the front garden. And it was a really emotional experience. And, you know, be honest, both of us were in tears. And by getting that sort of almost like cathartic emotion out, it gave me a chance to try and understand where, you know, here is a man that most of the generation, a lot of the people listening to this podcast probably don't really know very much about. But in the West Midlands, he was known as the King. When he actually went to the church for his funeral, the crowds leaned out to touch the coffin. And that's the impact that football, you know, the silly little game that gets us all going, can have. And that's what I wanted to do throughout the book, is address the issues of modern football, but do it in a way, I want to try and do it through the eyes of people who are living those issues on a daily basis.
Someone asked me yesterday, Mike, what I was telling them about your book, and I don't want to blow smoke up your ass.
Please do.
Okay. I think I love your books. I've read them all, and I think they should be essential reading for anyone with a passing interest in football. And someone asked me what State of Play about, and I sort of thought for a second. I said, everything. It's about everything. And you've got some wonderful interviews in it. So much work has gone in. Arsene Wenger, Steven Gerrard, Sean Dyche. I really was really impressed with Emma Hayes, Chelsea women's team manager. Then you've Clattenburg, Ryan Atkin, who's the first openly gay referee. Drew Broughton, the psychologist. Is it unfair to ask you if there was a standout contributor?
Possibly. All in their own ways made sense and gave me insight that I didn't have before I started writing a book. Drew's a really interesting character. 22 clubs in a long career. And he's experienced the sort of circle of football life, if you like. He made his first team debut for Norwich at the age of 17. Very soon after, he was walking along the edge of the penalty area, minding his own business, and Gerry Taggart, the Northern Ireland defender of the time, gave him a right-hander and out of nowhere, and basically proceeded to bully him. As his career progressed, Drew became that bully. And as his career declined, and he ended up just outside the Football League in the Conference South, he was then being bullied by the 18, 19-year-old defenders on the way up. 600-odd games in a career, and he's using that very bitter experience to tell young players, look, this is the real world. I'm going to try and tell you about the lies and the deception and the bitterness of rejection, because you need to know that. Because all footballers are hiding an essential, a basic insecurity. And Drew is working with an England under 21 international who emphasises that point. Here's a kid, if you look at him on social media, living the dream. He's got the bling, he's got the following, got the money. But people don't realise that that kid cries himself to sleep at night because he's so insecure. He sits in his bedroom watching endless YouTube loops of Ronaldinho to try and get better. Yet his own club manager is basically saying, well, what have you got to worry about, kid? You've got the money, you've got the material rewards. And that's where I also try and emphasise within the book, and this is where Emma Hayes comes across really well, Barry, I think, the emotional intelligence that's required to get the best out of people in modern football. It's coming through. We've seen it with Gareth Southgate, and we're seeing, you know, the old school counterproductive sort of command and control style of Jose Mourinho, who, you know, frankly, you know, by refusing or by fining Martial for wanting to stay with his partner after childbirth, frankly, how can someone like that galvanise a group of individuals, a group of men who would all relate with Martial? I just thought that was, you know, mad. But so overall, if, you know, without, I know this is a very long-winded answer, Barry, but you are right, it is everything. I'm trying to touch all the bases that I can and provide a snapshot in the way that Hopcraft provided the perfect snapshot of football in 1968, you know, when women, you know, when women's football was still banned, for instance. I'm trying to do the same, and I know it's a really impudent thing to do, but I'm trying to do the same thing for 2018.
Hopcraft, actually, he didn't have to contend with fan TV, which you seem to hold in loaded particular contempt.
Well, it's it's part of, basically, the book, each chapter begins with a quote, and I started the chapter that I did with Arsene Wenger and Sean Dyche with a quote of some dolt from Arsenal TV. That, to me, emphasises the coarseness of what passes as public debate in football. There's no basis of balance, of honesty, of respect. You've got people whose reputations are trashed by individuals really who have very little idea of the nuances of the job and the complexities of the game. They're there. Yeah, they've got every right for their opinion. But what also disturbs me about fan TV is that it's becoming commercialised. You know, it's being monetized. And I don't think, I think it's got away from, you know, it's whatever founding principle it had. But Sean Dyche made the point, and he just made, again, very unusual for a Premier League manager. On his day off, he let me, I spent the day with him in his house in Northamptonshire. And as he said, look, I work in angry Britain, angry England. And football, in a way, reflects life. You know, we live in Brexit Britain where, you know, there's intolerance and it's becoming institutionalised. And he has to deal with that on a daily basis. And we live in a world of, you know, cowardly, manipulative cyber bullies. There are fan forums out there. There are some great, and I don't want this to be a blanket condemnation of that culture, because there's some fantastic, you know, fan forums and bloggers and, you know, who really care about their game. But there are some which are just basically private little bitch fests. And when owners start to take notice of that, you've got real problems, because the professionals are not being judged accordingly. And it's a very, very difficult situation. You know, we're all in, you know, we all operate in the social media world, and we've all, I'm sure, had, you know, cases of, you know, being abused personally just because of we do what we do. I don't think you should have to put up with that. But in the case of a Premier League manager, is his ability to do the job being compromised by that sort of culture? And it worries me that sometimes it is.
You quote Arthur Hopcraft, the final paragraph of his book, when he says, "Even now, whenever I arrive at any football ground or merely pass close to one, when it's silence, I experience a unique alerting of the senses. The moment evokes my past in an instantaneous emotional rapport, which is more certain, more secret the memory. And I think, I don't know, every time I see a stadium or even just see people playing in a park, I just stop. I can't, you know, I get told off by the current Mrs. Rushton if we walk past this five-a-side pitch because I just lose all track of what we're talking about and I watch the game. But I wonder if we have to put our head in the sand to enjoy football because there's so much wrong with it, but we still want to love it.
We do, and it's funny you should come up with that quote because the book, which starts in Jeff Astle's living room, ends at a deserted Twerton Park, Bath City Football Club. And we were there. There were four of us there for a literary event, which was one of the great promotional fiascos of our time. We got there. It was myself, Tony Evans, Danny Kelly, and James Brown. And we got there, and they'd done no publicity. They hadn't told anyone about it, so we didn't have an audience. So they got six passers-by, dragged them off the street, and we said, right, okay, we're going to talk about football for an hour. Fancy a beer? So they sat, and we had a beer, and we talked about football, and we talked about that, about, you know, it's the impossibility of passing a playing field when there's a game on and not watching it. And the lady who runs the club, you know, when we were coming in, she sort of took me up into the main stand and sort of very angled steps up into the main stand. And we looked out and, you know, the pitch had been ravaged by the season, and there were nets above the terrace on the right-hand side where, you know, generations of mishit footballs had ended up to stop them going into the streets. And here's this little club basically looked down upon in a city which is devoted to rugby union. You know, doing very well in the southern in Conference South, I think. Mm-hmm. And she looked at it and she just said to me, "It's beautiful, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, it is." And then I went inside and I found the Skittles Alley, and there was a mascot's uniform, and I've always wanted to put a mascot's head on. So
why?
It was just, you know, you say we're all 10 years old.
What's the mascot?
It was a pig, so I had a big pink head on. It was great. I loved it. It was a highlight of my day.
Revealed the identity of West Brom's Combi Boiler.
We were saying last night, weren't we, Barry, about, you know, the poor man who has to dress as the Combi Boiler. Yeah. It's something I've always been dubious of, the grown adult who wants to get into the
yeah, I think that would make an unbelievably good TV documentary if you just went round, who are these guys?
Yeah. You said at the start, you know, you love the game, Lord, the industry. I'm always surprised by how many people and sort of intelligent people and adults who can't distinguish between the two. Does it surprise you?
In a way, no, because I think, you know, we're in a privileged position, aren't we? We understand the difference between the two. We, you know, we record both. And most people's association with football is from the heart. It's you know, an association with a club or a particular player or whatever it is. And, you know, you want to see, you see the good in that, and you live, you know, the sort of ups and downs of life through that football club. But the fact that, you know, as in Charlton's case, you know, the owner is stiffing the employers.
The thing you mentioned about the crew meeting, you know, where the chairman of crew was applauded for refusing to discuss.
Well, that to me was when, you know, I did a there's a chapter in there on fans. You know, went to the food banks in Liverpool, some fantastic work done there. But I ended that chapter on that scene at Career Alexandra where John Bowler was. It was meant to be an open evening, but you had security guards outside with mugshots of journalists who weren't going to be allowed in. And a very respected BBC local radio commentator, the sports editor of BBC Radio Stoke, if I believe, been covering crew for 25 years, and he asked the question about the whole sexual abuse scandal and was basically dismissed by Mr. Bowler, who had every, you know, that's his right if he wishes to. But what disturbed me, and I listened to the tape of the evening, was the applause that he got for that and the laughter at the journalist who asked that question. And that, to me, is where tribalism goes completely toxic. That you've got, you know, just because, you know, the someone like Ben Orr wore the colours of that particular club, it's wrong to assume that as because you're a follower of that, you can minimise it in any way. Which I think, you know, if that had happened, something, you know, God forbid, anything like that had happened to those fans who laughed in their own personal lives, they would have had every right to want support and action. And to actually put it into context, I asked a brilliant blogger, Alan Fisher, who works with sexually abused victims, to try and put it into context, because he's a fan, but he's also a professional, works in that field. And he talks about, he sits, his daily experience is to sit across a desk from a sexual abuser. And he talked to him, he talks about the importance of silence to people like that. And I'm afraid in that room, it wasn't quite silent, but it had the same effect.
Finally, is the future bright?
As long as people believe, as long as people want to be involved in the game, I think it will become much more exploitative, much more elitist. I think the Premier League will very probably dissolve into some sort of pan-European, or be superseded by some sort of pan-European experience. Jonathan's point, I went to Barcelona and spent some time with Pep Segura there, the general manager, who's, you know, in essence is the sort of power behind the throne there. And he's talking in terms of, La Liga seems to be very poorly organised, and basically playing the important Champions League games at weekends. And he said that's something that
I'm sure that will happen.
Real Madrid,
5-10 years.
Yeah, well, we were talking in terms of within a 5-year time frame that will happen.
Yeah, and probably more of them.
So it'll change, but as a football fan, you hark back to how football was when you were a kid, right?
And it can be though, Max. I spent some time during the season with Accrington Stanley, and their owner, Andy Holt, he sees through the facade of the industry of football. When they went up, the night they went up, I don't know if you've been to the Wham Stadium, but the main stand's got about 5 or 6 rows deep. And 5 minutes after the final whistle, the place is going schizoid. It's lovely. And a guy fights his way through the fans, who are literally sort of bouncing around the concourse, and he goes up to Andy, who's sitting there with his best mate with a pint in his hand, just trying to take it all in. And this guy said, Andy, thank you. And he couldn't get anything else out because he actually dissolved into tears. Now, this is a guy of about 45 years old, and he melted back into that crowd as though he was almost like ashamed of his emotion. Now, that is a community football club which is excelling today. If you look at Accrington as a town, 35,000 people, economically deprived. That football club gets maybe, 2,500 through the gate. 10,000 people out of that 35,000 people in that town are directly affected by the football club because they're involved in the community programs, and there's a brilliant autism project being done there. That is, I would hope to be, and this is that's where my heart lies, is rather than that sort of pan-European league that we talked about, is a community club. It matters to people on a daily basis, and there's a sense of identification, there's a sense of because we do live in a pretty dislocated world these days, a football club can be a point of contact that people cherish, and it's not a business. It's far more important than that, and that's why I think there will be a gradual migration, maybe away from the Premier League towards clubs like Cambridge. You've got your 2,500.
We'll be in the Premier League in 5 years in the Pan Weekend Champions League games. That'll be us.
Dream the dream.
But that's fascinating stuff, and that'll do for part 2. In part 3, we'll look ahead to the weekend's fixtures. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Games coming up tonight. Burnley's European dream continues as they go to Olympiacos. Celtic go to Suduva. Rangers play Ufa. I've heard of Olympiacos, which puts me more into that game than the other two. Burnley and how their European form or their European adventure will affect their Premier League status, Barry. I think they're in Europe and they should just absolutely love this. And I think the fans believe the same.
Yeah, I'd go for it. You know, they probably won't get relegated. They might, even if they do. You know, as we always say, you don't go over the edge of a cliff never to be seen again. But yeah, they should totally embrace it because for fans of a team like Burnley, it's an experience they've never had before. Well, many of them, you know, only the very elderly will have had it before. So, yeah, absolutely.
And we laughed at their first draw being against Aberdeen in a European adventure. But then, you know, going to Istanbul and now going to Olympiacos, Mike, it's great, isn't it?
It's great. That I had a beer with a Burnley fan about 3 days ago, and he was getting some drip from his wife because he was going. And he was going to fly in to Albania because it was cheaper to get into Greece via Albania. And that's the sort of common experience of the football fan, isn't it? You know that when the draw is made, EasyJet are going to go, yes, thank you very much. We've got another lot of coming here. And yeah, he was absolutely beside himself. It was the little boy getting on the charabanc on the school holiday and, you know, going down at the seaside. It's brilliant.
There's an article doing the rounds with Cambridge fans about how we are unbeaten in Europe. In the Anglo-Italian Cup, we drew with Sunderland and Birmingham. We're knocked out, but we've never lost in Europe. Gary says, does the signing of Kyle Lafferty prove that Stevie G is using his pulling power to bring the glitz and glamour back to Rangers, Jonathan?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Rangers have quite a pull anyway, I think, even without Steven Gerrard, but possibly. He was at Hearts, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yes.
So, I mean, yeah.
He left Rangers under a cloud, didn't he? I think his I'm back statement was quite apologetic by the sound of things.
Sorry, everybody. Here yeah. I am.
Was it Kyle Lafferty who was at Palermo?
Yeah, his chairman denounced him as a serial womaniser who was only interested in drinking and chasing skirt.
Well, with Rangers and Celtic in the competition, it'd be great if they met each other whenever teams from the same nations are allowed to meet each other.
Oh, meeting the final in Baku.
Were you impressed?
Imagine those EasyJet flights to Baku, going from Glasgow to Baku. Absolute carnage.
Were you impressed with Gerrard? Mike, he seems to have got off to a good start at Rangers.
Yeah, I was, to be honest, quite surprised that he went to Rangers. It's a bit like walking into a burning building, isn't it? I think you look at, you know, here's a guy who is known to an entire city by his first name, Stephen. He has essentially emotionally carried Liverpool on his back for, 10, 15 years. So he's not unaccustomed to that sort of level of almost personal responsibility for a football club. I find him quite, he's very driven. I went up to see him and the appointment was 8 o'clock and I got there about 20 to 8 and he'd been in there over an hour. This is when he was at Liverpool in the academy. And I watched him, he did the grunt work. You know, he carried the mannequins around. He had this knack of using his experience and his status and his legend by pulling, you know, these young players and having a quiet word. But without, you know, because he said, the one thing I'm learning is that I've got to almost like monitor my body language. I've got to work on my tone of voice when I'm talking to these players. And the one thing I'm not going to do is, you know, ram home my career by showing him all these videos of me playing, because that would be counterproductive. I'm done. I'm done as a player. I'm here as a coach and a manager. And I was, I suppose, the one word that summed him up to me was diligence. I thought, yeah, this guy's not messing around. He's going to have a good go at it.
Seems to me Mike got more out of Steven Gerrard than I did when I had that fist pump in a urinal once. Rosenberg play Skindja of Macedonia. Nicholas Bentner is now at Rosenberg. He's been up to some fun recently. He was told he was to be dropped for poor form and being out of shape, so he went onto his Instagram and took a photo of him with four tubs of Ben and Jerry's and a bottle of caramel sauce. In the Premier League, Manchester United Spurs on Monday night, Jonathan. This is a big game, isn't it, for Jose?
Yeah. That defeat at Brighton means there's pressure immediately, and the sort of the summer of grumpiness could very quickly become a season of grumpiness. And I thought it was extraordinary about the Brighton game, which is how bad they were defensively. And I started to wonder whether we gave them a bit of a free pass defensively last season. They only let in 28 goals, so only one more than City, which sounds great. But De Gea made 115 saves last season, which is the fifth most in the division. But the other four, I think, were the keepers of Everton, Brighton, Swansea and Stoke. So two relegated teams plus Brighton and Everton. So United shouldn't be fifth in that chart. I mean, yeah, your goalkeeper's obviously part of your team, and if your goalkeeper makes great saves, fantastic. But they probably shouldn't be relying on him that much. So I think that's a sort of a concern that maybe we didn't quite see last season that we should have done, that United are not defensively as a Jose side should be.
You can see him grinding out a 1-0 against Spurs, though.
Well, they did last season. Yeah. It was a horrible game, and then it was just a long ball flicked on, wasn't it? And Lukaku got the winner.
The protest, Barry, with the banner and the plane that Man United fans had planned, not against Jose, against the Glazers and Ed Woodward, has had to be postponed because they've realised it's going to be dark on Monday night. They're going to do it the following Sunday at Burnley instead. Spurs are going to consult fans over where to play their Carabao Cup third round fixture. It was confirmed this week they would not be able to use Wembley.
Can they play in New York? Malaysia?
I mean, I think, you know, Regent's Park. So come on, let's take it. Let's find one of those Southern Amateur League pitches. Take it to Winchmore Hill, you know, where they have to put the nets up themselves. That would be fun.
There's
a playing field just at the back. You know, the Labour Club opposite the old.
You can see it from the train platform.
Yeah. Well, there are some playing pitches there. And normally they are literally jumpers for goalposts. I think they should go there.
It's a great idea.
But this issue with Spurs, and you know, there's, you know, the law, you're not allowed to play home games in more than one ground, and it's obviously being bent this season, and entirely legitimately. But I do wonder if this is sort of a thin end of the wedge, and you know, the opposite of what you were talking about, Accrington Stanley, that in how long will these big clubs be completely divorced from their locality, and you know, a team like Barcelona, say, we'll play half a dozen home games in Barcelona and then two in New York and two in Tokyo and two in Kuala Lumpur. And it becomes just this global event. Yeah. And that's why I think that law is actually quite significant, although it clearly Tottenham have good reason.
So Tottenham have good reason, but you can see this being exploited in
yeah, I think we've got to be nefarious ways. We shouldn't just sort of laugh off that law. We should sort of respect the spirit of it. And Tottenham, should absolutely be given dispensation this season to play where they need to play. Perhaps being fined for it, I don't know. But, there's a need to protect that.
Wolves play Manchester City. Apparently City contemplating an emergency loan move for Keylor Navas from Real Madrid following Claudio Bravo's injury. Given that Pep is a total genius and dots every I and crosses every T, does seem strange. I mean, I know he wasn't a big fan of Joe Hart, but it seems strange that he's left himself open here in the goalkeeping department.
Well, he has his first choice keeper. He has a reserve keeper. I get the impression he would rather play Ilkay Gundogan in goal than play Joe Hart. So I don't think he will regret selling Joe Hart. Joe Hart probably didn't want to be there. And if he's allowed to get an emergency loan in, then, you know, I don't see it as some huge calamity.
Why can't they play an 18-year-old?
Exactly. Have a keeper in the academy. Absolutely.
And that's what teams would have used to do. You know, Sunderland's youngest ever player, Derek Forster, was 15. Played, I think, five or six games because of goalkeeping injuries. Was Dennis Tewes' best man.
I mean, I presume Manchester City, they have their first choice. They have that young local lad.
Who's Daniel Grimshaw.
Yes, and I presume there's probably about five other goalkeepers there, minimum age 17 or over. So, yeah, you know.
They just brought in a 16-year-old from...
Ireland, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's staying in Ireland to complete his schooling.
But your point is right. You know, what is the point of having a £200 million academy if... under circumstances of duress, you don't actually take advantage of that. It just shows up, you know, the whole academy thing for what it is. It's just another, you know, glorified bit of propaganda.
Are you saying, Barry, that if Manchester City, if Edison was sent off and Manchester City had used all their substitutes, Gundogan is the player that you would, in what is clearly the greatest moment in football where an outfield player goes in goal, would take the Niall Quinn role, who obviously saved a penalty once for Man City. Is he the City player you'd pick?
Not necessarily. He was just the first one that sprang to mind.
Okay.
And he's taller than Sergio Aguero.
Yes. Okay. He's 5'11". So there you go. If anybody wondered at the height
of
Gundogan.
I reckon John Stones would take the gloves.
Yeah, it'll be him, or if Otamendi was playing...
No, I think Stones.
Mendy would do it for the last. for his Instagram. He'd be straight in there. Arsenal-West Ham, Jonathan, is a huge match, isn't it, given that there are no points on the board for either side?
Yeah, and West Ham, who I'd allow myself to fall into the trap of thinking, oh, they've bought quite well this summer. And, of course, West Ham never do that.
I fell into that trap last year. God knows why.
I mean, Yarmolenko is a proper West Ham signing, and you know, something he was promising 5 years ago. So the losing at home to Bournemouth has put enormous pressure on West Ham, and you're well beaten in that game. Absolutely bad second half. We've sort of given Emery a bit of a free pass given who Arsenal played the first two games. But if they suddenly didn't win that one, then there's huge pressure on him. So yeah, that is a massive game.
Richarlison, the only one of Everton's new signings to start a game so far. It hasn't really mattered to them yet, has it, Mike? That's reasonable.
No. I have to say I was one of those ones whose eyebrows went north the moment I heard about the fee, 40 million. He had five or six good games at the start of last season for Watford. Essentially went out on strike in sympathy with Marco Silva when he was quite, I think, correctly bulleted by Watford. Three goals in two games.
You did say in your book there's extenuating circumstances, perhaps, though, about Richarlison's loss of form.
Well, it was actually... He when he arrived at Watford, he lived in a hotel and went down to the restaurant every evening, and it was basically burgers and chips and fish and chips and steak and chips. And he lost 5 kilograms because he was missing his home food. And he was picked up by the sort of football's Brazilian diaspora. David Luiz came round, Aurelio Gomez came round, and they found him a Brazilian supermarket where he could get his meat, rice and peas. That was his staple diet. And happy bunny. And soon put the weight back on. So I suppose that does emphasise the point that, you know, we're all making really instant judgment on players without actually understanding the full sort of range of personal experiences they're going through. So if you take as an example, you know, Will Sahar, when he was at Manchester United, I'm told he's living on his own in digs in Stockport. He's got a manager who's not really talking to him. Surprise, surprise, he doesn't fulfil his potential at that football club. And I think... you know, we're all rushing to judgment on clubs because it's quite good fun. But in essence, we probably, you know, it's the old 10 game rule, isn't it? We have to look at players and clubs after 10 games. As you said, Max, Everton haven't got their, you know, Mina and people like that haven't played yet.
Yeah, so Digne has played 5 minutes. Bernard, Gomez, Mina, Zuma all yet to get on the pitch.
Yeah, and so, you know, let's you know, have a little look maybe after the, you know, the international break and see how they're getting on.
I think it can be quite a healthy thing anyway. I mean, if you think how Liverpool used to do things, if he'd sign a player, you wouldn't see him for 6 months because he had to sort of bed into the Liverpool way of doing things. So if you can be picking up points and Everton have got 4 points, one of those having played an hour with 10 men, and then you've got new players to bring in as they settle, that seems to me a very positive way of doing it if you can.
And as Paolo Bandini has pointed out, you know, players can get better, can improve or get worse, and we make a snap judgment the first time we see any footballer play. That's how good Nigel Kwasi is, and he will be no better or no worse for the rest of his career. Sid Lowe has tweeted, reading about the new La Liga rules in AS, includes this: mascots can't be bigger than a normal person. So, Mike, you certainly wouldn't be able to go there with your pig's head on.
No.
Wouldn't be allowed in. What a great...
Hang on, a normal person.
I mean, there are so many, you know, they've got a big meeting. They're planning all these things, right? They're planning moving to games to America. And
yeah, does that mean like Peter Crouch couldn't do it because he's bigger than a normal person?
I mean, I don't have all the details, but it seems totally ridiculous that any amount of time.
Could the combi boiler get away with it? I know there's some, you know, pretty hefty lads out there on the terraces. Could you get away with that?
Well, the combi boiler looks like one of those bodybuilding types who never do leg day. You know, it's all from the waist up.
So it's more
that's what kind of he reminds me of.
Which is more cuboid, the combi boiler or Artem Shaqiri?
Oh, that's true. I mean, if you put Shaqiri in the boiler suit, then you've got some. Then you've got the zenith of man, haven't you? A tweet from Sampdoria's English Twitter account. That's a sign when you've made, you know...
I said Artem Shaqiri, who's a Macedonian player who scored against England 2-2.
I meant
Sheridan Shaqiri, sorry.
Well, obviously, he could have had great carbs as well.
Do you remember that 2-2 draw to Southampton? Alan Smith was sent off? I think he might have scored out from a corner. Somebody scored out from a corner that day. I was in Belgrade. They beat Serbia beat Finland 2-1. Anyway, carry on, sorry.
No. I hope it... I hope that survives the edit. And on that note, we'll finish today. Thank you for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. Buy me a book.
Yes. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much. Buy my book and buy Jonathan's book.
Buy Mike's as well. Sorry, that's ungracious.
Get them, please, and read them. We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.